Guess what? You work in a cubicle. You sit there, you look at your computer all day long. Maybe you goof around, look at Facebook or whatever. You've got vermin in your office, and that could be rats or bats, or that could be the people you work with, and you've got people who put you down and ignore you and don't appreciate you. Melissa McCarthy, as Susan Cooper, has those things too. But she, unlike you, is getting ready to have a life of espionage, excitement, and adventure in the current box office hit, Spy. Join us now on Agents of Cool as we discuss this box office success and discuss a number of other upcoming spy extravaganzas. All right, welcome to Agents of Cool. We are your podcast home for the super spies of the 1960s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and today, their cultural significance, their impact, and the just plain old-fashioned entertainment value. We have Ray over here, our podcast Q. We have Stacy over here, our podcast Mrs. Peel. And you have me, Eric, your grumpy-ass podcast number six over in the corner, muttering and bitter. And I remind you before you get too critical of me that just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you. Today we're going to be discussing the new trailers for Spectre, for Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, and for the reboot of Man from U.N.C.L.E. So before we get started, guys, anything on your minds?
Well, after that intro, it's kind of a hard act to follow.
We got everything covered? Okay, good. Let's start with the TV spot for Spectre. Now, these three particular advertisements, we watched them before we came down here to record. I'm looking at these things and, oh my God, they make me happy just looking at them. Spectre. Ironically, the Bond preview is the one, if we're going on a 1 to 10 scale, I'd put the Bond at maybe an 8. I would put Mission Impossible at 9. I'd put Man from U.N.C.L.E. at 10. Well, scale of 1 to 10, Man from U.N.C.L.E. is the one that got me straight tripping.
The Man from U.N.C.L.E. one is probably the most new footage, the most that just, you know, has a narrative and runs through it.
Stylistically and tonally.
Yeah, and the music, the act, just the whole nine yards. It is, you know, of the three, it's the best package. The Bond one is probably the weakest, and or at least it's pretty much all the same footage we've seen before. It's just
a lot of it.
It's a pretty much a recut. I think there's a little bit of the, you know, there's a couple of the snows, you know, the little shooting up on the mountain. But frankly, we've probably all seen those from just the little making of featurette dropped a couple months back when the first trailers did. So it doesn't tell us anything more. It's pretty much, I mean, it's a lot of the same cuts and the same voiceovers, which may not belong to those scenes. Other thing to keep in mind with these
good
sorts
point.
Of things.
Good point. I do love the look of Spectre. Now, just because I rank it a little bit behind the other ones doesn't mean I am not straight over the moon excited about the movie.
Oh, we're still going to be the opening night.
Oh, my God, yes. Just, oh, my Lord, yes.
You know, of the three, and, you know, I think Mission Impossible kind of, for me, fell kind of in the middle in that it's, we're now going to go down the big set piece stunts where, you know, it looks like Tom Cruise is about to get mauled or fall to his death or
going home to Xenu, as they call it on the set. So there's that. Going home to Xenu.
Yeah.
Mr. Cruz, if by some incredible mischance you happen to be listening to this, please just understand that we're a bunch of sarcastic middle-aged guys down here in a basement, and don't take it too harshly.
Joseph on your doorstep, I don't know you.
Okay, so looking at Spectre, it's brooding. It's ominous. This one and the other ones, I like that they're not desaturated, that current fad towards the desaturation of action films. I like that these movies seem to have very bright color palettes. I love the golds and the browns and the kind of ominous inky shadows of Spectre. I love the brooding tone of it. I love that there are secrets and lies. And it feels of a piece with Skyfall, except if you can imagine it on an even bigger scale. It feels of a piece with Skyfall, and it feels of a piece with Ian Fleming. So if you've ever read any of Ian Fleming's stuff, and if you haven't, and you're listening to this podcast, go read some. Just pick one. I might recommend On Her Majesty's Secret Service. Alarmingly tight piece of writing. Goldfinger's great from Russia with Love. But it feels very much of a piece with Ian Fleming and with the previous film in the canon.
It's definitely got the same sort of darker, brooding feel we got out of Skyfall versus... Actually, all of the Craig Bonds have been fairly broody movies. He has a...
But not unentertaining. Not
no, bro- not this bad
is,
broody.
This is not Chris Nolan wants to bring you down with Batman.
No. It's not that, and it's not just people being earnestly serious the whole time.
You know, we should trademark that. Bringing you down with Chris Nolan. That should be like a whole... We should trademark that, because that's going to be a real thing.
I think we can trademark other people's names, can we?
Well, we can try. Can't hurt, can it? I mean, Dark Knight Rises, I love Batman Begins... I love it. I rewatch Batman Begins. I think that one's fantastic. The Dark Knight, I just can't.
Really? I thought seriously? That was the best one.
Well, I'm watching it, and it just feels bringing me down. It just brings me down.
It's pretty bleak. It's pretty bleak. Almost like the second Matrix movie, in that, you know, it ends on a fairly bleak point, yeah. And you know there's a third movie, so this isn't how it's going to end. It's not like, and then it ends, and the movie, you know, the sequel is never made.
Well,
so,
let me ask you this. Did you ever watch Dark Knight Rises?
Yeah.
Did you watch it more than once?
No.
There you go.
Okay. Now, it's okay. I mean, the fact that it ends on kind of a downer, it's kind of it's a bit of an homage to the Dark Knight Returns comic and such. I mean, there's, you know, obviously it's very much in that headspace. And what cushions the blow somewhat is there's going to be a third movie.
Yeah.
There should be, you know, there'll be some, you know, there'll be that rising action, which you do get in Dark Knight Rises. Yeah. It's literally called The Dark Knight Rises. Was Dark Knight Rises perfect? No, there's places where it didn't make a lick of sense.
It was a half an hour too long, and there are places it didn't make a lick of sense. And it's 2 hours and 45 minutes, and you've got 5 minutes of Batman in the Batman movie.
Yeah, it's a bit Batman light, but on the other hand, it does have some nice scenes. It's got, I mean,
cut the yard, if nothing else.
I mean, it's almost, you can make the case, it's as much a Jim Gordon movie as it is a Batman movie.
Yeah, it is.
You do get, I think, a fair amount of Batman, a fair amount of Bruce Wayne. Mm. You get a fair amount of intrigue and such. I mean, you look at what they had and what they did with it. I'm like, yeah, that was okay. You know, I was really wanting to be carried out on the orchestral swells of the movie on a cloud of happy.
A cloud of happy bats.
Yeah.
A cloud of happy bats.
It came close. I mean, again, the scene, you know, I thought the scene with Alfred in Paris was very sweet.
Really nice. Yeah, I like that too.
You know, you kind of needed that, because at that point, if you don't get that scene, you basically have sad Michael Caine crying in a cemetery. And that's just not a way to end a movie.
That's not how you end your Batman movie. Now, point being that Daniel Craig's Batman movies. Daniel Craig's,
that would be interesting.
Now, I would actually watch that shit, too. I think that would be good.
That would be weird.
I would really watch that. But Daniel Craig's...
How would Craig's, that
work? He would be an even more angry, craggy sort of Batman.
Yeah. I would take Daniel Craig as Batman more than I'd take Ben Affleck, but that's going to be our other podcast. Dan Craig as James Bond. His movies are broody, but they're not Chris Nolan, Tap of Vane broody. Skyfall in particular is dark and it is ominous, but it is somehow, Bond movies aren't really trying to be life affirming. They're not that kind. They're not like Oscar Lifetime, Stephen Hawking kind of life affirming movies, but you walk out of Skyfall and it's just bam, the bad guys are put away and it's fun and it's entertaining and you feel good when you walk out.
Skyfall, I mean, that one's, it still ends on kind of a somber note. I mean, it does. You know, not everybody makes it out
of Skyfall, and yet you feel good inside.
There's closure to what
things are right with the world.
Well, the fact that it very deliberately establishes the status quo from the very first James Bond movies.
which admittedly helps. I mean, it makes you feel happy.
That gives you your sense back. Okay, think, you know, kind of like the scene in Paris in Dark Knight Rises. Equilibrium has been restored. Okay, can all the bad things that have happened be undone? No, obviously not. But you can get it back to a point where things are back to what the new normal is, and it's a normal. It's not the aberration. It is not the disruption from what we consider normal that the entire movie has been about enduring through and correcting.
It does look like Spectre is also going to be about the past coming back to haunt you, in this case, Bond himself rather than M.
That's a really good point. I hadn't thought of that. That's a really good point, and it should be really rich territory. I guess the big question is, and I've read a little bit about this, Christoph Waltz, he of Django Unchained. He was that massively oily Nazi from Inglourious Basterds. Christoph Waltz is playing.
There were
a lot of Nazis. He was the one with the big pipe in the opening scene.
There is an entire field of in Texas of oily Nazis in that movie. I'm not. I don't really like that movie.
I don't really like that one either.
If my brother-in-law is listening, I still don't like that movie. It's nothing personal. I just don't like that movie.
I was promised a Quentin Tarantino World War II Men on a Mission movie, and what I get is a movie about a Jewish girl pretending to be a Gentile hiding out in occupied Paris and running a movie theater, which is fine.
I actually liked that part.
I mean, I'm not saying that part's a bad movie. It's not the movie I wanted.
There are a number of issues I had with that movie, but it wasn't...
We'll save that for our Tarantino podcast. Yeah, you're not wrong about any of your objections to that movie. Christoph Waltz, he's been having a huge, like, that movie gave him a huge career boost. He was the villain in that faintly lamentable Green Hornet movie. Yeah.
Wait, he was the crazy Russian mobster?
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Okay, he was the best part of that movie. I wanted to see a movie about crazy Russian mobster who decides to become a supervillain. That would have actually been
a better movie than
the
movie got.
Yeah, I think just from his point of view, it's just like, no, you know, he's just, he, I mean, he's really working, he's getting into it, he's like, you know, he's, I thought that was...
Bludnovsky.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, he was, you know, trying to find himself in this new crazy world of, you know.
That would actually be a much more interesting movie than the one that they made. So he's in Spectre. He's playing a character named Franz Oberhauser, who is apparently the son of Bond's childhood ski instructor.
Right, who actually is mentioned in the Fleming canon once.
Who's actually mentioned in the Fleming canon. Now, also off on a little bit of a tangent here, Barbara Broccoli is the daughter of Cubby Broccoli, the guy who, of course, was one of the producers of, one of the guys that brought you the James Bond series from Dr. No up through GoldenEye, and he's passed it down to the hands of his daughter, Barbara, and his stepson, Michael Wilson. And before Cubby passed, he tells her, and it tells Michael too, he tells her, if you get in trouble, if you don't know where the series is going, go back to Fleming. Always go back to the Fleming. And I'm thinking this is what she's doing. She's pulling details and bits and pieces from the Fleming canon that haven't been in the films yet. And she's still using the core text, if you will, as her guide in making these films. Now, if you've got a movie that's called Spectre, about the return of the international terror organization Spectre, and you've got Christoph Waltz in it, and he's playing a character named Franz Oberhauser. I got five on the table right now, says that's not the guy's necessarily a real name.
You think it might be a pseudonym?
That might be, it could be a nom de guerre, if you will.
Interesting.
I don't know. I don't know if Ian Productions is actually expecting to fool anybody with this. I think, probably he's playing Blofeld. I don't know why you get an actor of that caliber and he's not fucking Blofeld.
It's kind of like Benedict Cumberbatch is totally not playing Khan, and this movie is totally not Star Trek 2.
The movie actually wasn't Star Trek 2. No, he should not have played Khan. They at least
shouldn't have tried to come up with someone he was playing who was not Khan.
They shouldn't have gone to that particular well. That well you can only go to at the end, as it were.
So, Spectre. I am like straight tripping for this movie. They got a lot of the same writers back. They got the same director back. A lot of the same behind the scenes people. They got even more money. There's apparently the Sony email hacks. Did you guys hear about that? As near as I can tell, this is what happened. Sony released the movie where the guy who was in that shitty Green Hornet movie tried to kill the dictator of North Korea.
Right.
And then North Korea turned around and hacked all of Sony's private emails. So every crappy thing they say to themselves about each other or all the people in Hollywood and all their dirty laundry is all out there at WikiLeaks or wherever for you to peruse right now. And apparently the budget on Spectre is coming in somewhere north of $250.
Wow.
And that's what got out. Now, that may be true and that may not be true. That may be an early budget that they got down. I don't know.
And that's just production, not marketing?
Production. I was led to believe in what I read about it that was production.
Wow. That's, they're pulling out all.
They're pulling out all the stops.
Well, this is kind of their GoldenEye. You know, GoldenEye was the Bond, the Bond franchise is in trouble. We need to right the ship. We need a big success. And GoldenEye was basically, okay, what wasn't working in the James Bond movies? Let's get back. They were trying to get back to what they considered at the time the basics of your James Bond movie.
Now, that's an interesting thought because most people agree, with the exception of Gina, who may or may not be listening to this, and if she is listening to it, hi, Gina, and you're wrong about Skyfall. But Skyfall is generally regarded as actually the one that rights the ship, kind of putting Bond and recontextualizing him maybe for this part of the 21st century that we're in right
Quantum
now.
Quantum is the only weak one of the series.
Casino Royale was regarded as a big success, coming back and kind of rebooting the series and getting back to Fleming and telling a really exciting, slick, contemporary, modern action movie. Quantum of Solace erred too much on the Bourne side of the equation, if you will, generally acknowledged to have done so. Skyfall is the one that people say kind of put things back in order. So do you think Skyfall didn't do the job?
Well, no, I think, but how long was the gap between Skyfall and Spectre?
It was a four-year gap, but a lot of that was studio trouble.
Right, but okay, that's the thing. Not from so much the audience, but from the getting the studio back together. The studio needs to do a success. If this one flops, then the whole Bond franchise is in trouble. And there's been a bunch of stuff behind the scenes that would make it, that has made it difficult to get out a new James Bond movie. I don't think they would have waited four years to get one out.
Because Skyfall was successful.
Yeah, it was quite,
Skyfall was monstrously successful. It did north of $1 billion domestic and global
combined.
And
they were doing every other year for a while.
Yeah,
So
this is almost like we missed a cycle from the studio accounting standpoint. Is we missed a whole giant revenue cycle. The money guys, they don't care who's making the movie, see the Transformers franchise, as long as the money comes in.
Yeah.
So I guess not so much in the cultural zeitgeist of getting Bond out there. He hasn't been out there for 4 years, and the public does have kind of a short memory for some stuff. But
Bond is what I can't believe they'd have too short a memory for Bond.
Maybe not. That's not the best way to phrase it. It doesn't take much to stir the public's memory of Bond. Play those little bars,
and people's blood pressure goes up.
Is Craig getting up there now and having been Bond the longest? Especially because of that gap?
Just in terms of number of years. So we're 2006 to
he hasn't had very many movies.
That's kind of like Paul McGann was the longest longest serving Doctor.
Right. Even though he only had the one adventure. Right. So, okay, let me run this through my head. That's Dan Craig from 2006 to 2015. Casino Royale to Spectre. That's 9 years. Roger was Bond from 74 through 85, which is 11 years.
So Roger still has it.
Roger still has, I think, the Timothy Dalton was 87 through 95, which is 8 years.
Well, okay. Most of those years he wasn't actually in anything, but if we're counting the gaps, then...
And Connery
Brosnan was only 95 to 2002, so not very many at all.
But he was still the Bond of record until they announced Craig in 2005.
That's true.
So
he twice as many movies as Dalton, right?
That's true.
Interestingly enough, I was poking around on Christopher Lee's IMDb page this week. Christopher Lee, the legendary performer who passed away very recently as we're recording this. Christopher Lee was related to Ian Fleming. They were cousins. Christopher Lee and Ian Fleming were cousins. There's a possibility that they may have participated together in whatever unspecified World War II activities that they're too gentlemanly to talk about.
So I get the impression Fleming didn't actually do a lot of the cutting people stuff, whereas Christopher Lee apparently
I think may have. There's a quote from Christopher Lee on his IMDb page that, based on his discussions with Ian Fleming about the people they knew in common who inspired James Bond, Pierce is the closest. That Pierce is the closest to the authentic Bond based on Christopher Lee's recollections of the men that inspired the character.
Wow.
Interesting.
That's an interesting thing to know, isn't it? That Sean Connery, no, George Lazenby, bite me.
I'd like Lazenby.
I like Lazenby, too. Well, no, I wasn't saying bite me about Lazenby. I actually quite like Lazenby, too. I think Lazenby really should have given himself a chance in the part. And I think that movie is hugely underrated just because nobody knows who he is.
Yeah, apparently he hooked up with someone who decided he should really join the counterculture and be a hippie right after that.
Yeah,
and
so tell us how that worked out for you.
Being the clean-cut administrator of violence was apparently not the sort of part he wanted to continue.
Yeah, he showed up at the premiere of Honor, Majesty, Secret Service looking like Dan freaking Haggerty.
I mean, some people make bad career decisions.
That was one
of the worst.
That was one of the worst ever. So Spectre, we're all thumbs up on the preview, right?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. All super jonesing for it,
yes,
right?
Yes. That's like as a trailer, it was okay as a trailer. As a vehicle to make me realize, oh wow, I can't wait for this movie to come out. Massively successful.
Oh absolutely.
So really, maybe actually as a maybe I should be rating it higher as a trailer because it certainly did the job of a trailer of making me think, wow, I have to wait this long to see the movie?
Exactly. Now fortunately, we don't have to wait as long to see the next hit. Mission Impossible Rogue Nation comes out, as we're recording this, comes out in just a little bit more than a month.
Wow.
Into July.
So we're all really jonesing for that, and I love the preview. Very exciting. We've talked about this on previous podcasts. I think Sarah Ferguson, the new female lead, is a very attractive woman, looks beautiful and dangerous and interesting and exotic. I think the cast of Mission Impossible guys, your Ving Rhames, your Simon Pegg, your Tom Cruise, your Jeremy Renner, Alec Baldwin looks, as always, like an officious slam ball I want to punch in the nose. Man, there was a time he was a leading man, and that was a long time ago.
Yeah.
And the stunts look fantastic, and the technology looks fantastic. It looks well filmed and photographed and everything. But the thing that strikes me about it is that it looks of its moment. It doesn't look like... Okay, in the way the next preview, we're going to talk about Man from U.N.C.L.E. looks like its moment, like 1962, 1963. I mean, whatever the year the film is actually. 63. It looks not modern. Like, it doesn't want to be modern. It doesn't need to be modern. But Mission Impossible, for some reason, wants to be modern. I mean, whatever that is, of its moment, contemporary, up to date. Yeah,
well, of the two franchises, Mission Impossible, the Mission Impossible movies have always been right here now.
Right.
Man from U.N.C.L.E., I think, has less cultural baggage to work with. Outside of folks like us, it doesn't quite have as much memory, as much cultural memory out there. So if they're going to do that, an updating of it would be hard, not to say geopolitically screwy, given that Russia is the current, they seem to be competing with North Korea for country run by a supervillain. And make it actually pretty good progress
When they were making this in the 60s, Russia was still the enemy.
Yes, but... The difference is today, two
points to Stacey for current cultural relevance of Man from U.N.C.L.E. Good show.
Yes, but today, if you wanted to do a modern updating of it, there's not really another opposing superpower. You've got a bunch of regional powers, and communism was bad, but it was kind of a faceless sort of bad, and that was kind of the big twist there. But it would be hard to imagine something short of like alien invasion that would be bad enough for us to team up with Vladimir Putin and his thugocracy.
Is he still irritated? He thinks he looks like Dobby from Harry Potter. Is he still irritated about that? Because that's hilarious.
We could be here all evening. Mm. There are any number of structural and geopolitical issues with Russia that are things are not going to be getting any better, probably going to be getting worse over there.
Yeah, very
and there's
likely.
A bizarre movement of people over here who have decided that Putin is more macho than Barack Obama. And
I don't think it's a large movement.
Okay. Now, whatever your politics happen to be, and, you know, I am willing to engage in intelligent, rational discourse with people who are, in fact, intelligent and rational. But when Steven Seagal gets out there and tells you that Vladimir Putin is probably tougher or a better leader or whatever, and you believe that, Steven Seagal should not be your political guru.
Yeah.
No. Mr. Seagal, if you're happening to listen to this, I am a little bit scared of you, but, you know, based on the last couple of pictures I saw, I'm pretty sure I'm still faster. So yeah, I'm going to have to let that one ride.
Okay, getting political advice from actors is about like getting political actors from basketball stars.
Well, yeah, exactly.
It's like, okay, Dennis Rodman, you know, the guy in charge of North Korea is a totally cool guy. No, you're insane. You're out of your goddamn mind.
Super villain. He's crazy, but you know, small, crazy, small guy, small country, crazy. Putin's the one that scares me. But anyway, Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, as the rest of the Mission Impossible films have been, are trying to be modern, trying to be of their moment, trying to be up to date in terms of design and cinematography and editing. And I think for some reason, Mission Impossible lends itself to that.
Well, I think where Mission Impossible started, I mean, the first Mission Impossible movie was what,
96. So, it was initially going to be Christmas in 95, but they didn't want to compete with GoldenEye, so they put it back 6 months.
Right, so they pretty much, they cast that, I mean, it started as a Tom Cruise vehicle. It's been reasonably successful as a Tom Cruise vehicle. They're not, going back to the green stuff, the green stuff keeps coming in, they're going to keep doing it.
Yeah.
So they pretty much cast the dive, making it an update. So that pretty much just set it on that course so that they pretty much run with that. Mm-hmm. With, again, you know, my thesis for Man from U.N.C.L.E. is they don't so much have that option, geopolitics being what it is, and they decided to go back to the original roots. And there's some nostalgia for that, and it's kind of stylish. So if you look at the trailer, they have completely and totally embraced that in terms of the production design, absolutely. The whole nine yards, the music.
The look of the trailer is like a 60s thing.
Which just makes me so happy. Now, Rogue Nation looks and feels modern, looks and feels like also Mission Impossible to me. The loyalty among the team, the reliance on technology, the core themes we've talked about in terms of Mission Impossible, this film looks very much to have those core values and the feel of proper Mission Impossible updated to $150 million blockbuster action movie. Man from U.N.C.L.E. is not doing that.
It took them, a few movies to actually work back up to maybe we should make the Mission Impossible movie about a team that does impossible missions.
And son of a gun, if the series didn't take off.
Maybe not always have the villains be from our organization.
Yeah. No,
Sleazeball Senator or whatever Alec Baldwin is kind of correct given what's happened over the last few years.
He's not so wrong.
The IMF is kind of dangerous.
They have had, Jim, okay, that is not Jim Phelps. I don't care what you people say. That was not Jim Phelps in the first Mission Impossible movie. That's somebody doubling Jim Phelps. It's Bob Phelps. I don't know who that is. That is not Peter Graves. It's John Voight. John Voight is not Peter Graves. Ergo, that is not the Jim Phelps from the TV show. Bite me. So, and then it was Duke Gray Scott in Mission Impossible 2, and it was Billy Crudup in Mission Impossible 3. So there does, in fact, Mr. Baldwin has a point in that there is a certain amount of vile Mendastian corruption at the heart of IMF as a government organization. I do think in updating the film to its times since the TV show, since Watergate, since all the stuff of the last 40 years, we do have a little more mistrust of our government than we did back in the day.
Hell, the stuff of the last 12 to 18 months, Edward Snowden, Clapper saying, no, we're totally not collecting Americans' metadata.
No, we're not recording your calls. No, we're not doing that. Okay, maybe we are. So yeah, it feels of its time and it feels of a piece with its source material too. Now, Man from U.N.C.L.E., again, as we talked about, we're not that necessarily up to date on it, but oh my God, that movie looks like so much fun. I love the way the saturated blue skies and the water in this new trailer, it looks like 60s film stock. And that's probably not a complicated thing to do to color grade films these days so that it's evocative of the textures and cinema of other eras.
I'm curious, did they shoot it on film? Did they shoot it on digital?
I don't know.
Almost never shoot things on film anymore.
There's some people who make a point of it.
Yeah,
they made a point of doing Force Awakens on 35mm, and some of your big shot directors, Chris Nolan, I think Spielberg, Tarantino, I think a few other guys Kodak was getting ready to phase out motion picture film. They were going to stop making film, but a lot of your big shots went up there and said, no, we're not going to do that.
Was 8mm shot on film? It would be funny if 8mm was shot on digital. That almost.
You mean Super 8?
Super 8, not what, oh,
right. 8 millimeter was the Nicolas Cage snuff movie.
That, you're
and
right.
Super 8 was the J.J. Abrams super nostalgic, you know, 70s.
Love letter to Steven Spielberg.
Love letter to Steven Spielberg.
If that would, if that was not shot on film, that would just be weird.
It would kind of be weird. J.J. prefers film. I know J.J. prefers film. I think Disney wanted him to shoot Force Awakens on like digital 3D, but he wanted to do it on film. So I won't be paying to see the 3D. Tangentially. As I say
that's
that,
a much better
I say that word wrong and it gets super embarrassing. Tangentially, I won't pay for post-converted 3D. You want me to pay for 3D? You shoot that mofo in 3D. But that's just me. Anyway.
I just thought of something. Speaking of tangentially, did we see any lens flares whatsoever in the Force Awakens trailer? I don't think we did.
I didn't see one.
I don't think we... That's good. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, that's very good. I mean, you know, admitting you have a problem is the first step, and quitting is hard. It's really hard. I'm glad he got help for his problem.
He admitted
his support
in the, in the first place. He admitted he had a problem, and that's a big, big first step.
Yeah, that's the most important step. Once you do that, it's much easier. And getting a good support group. I mean, I'm not sure.
Well, if Kathy Kennedy is not a good support group for a filmmaker, I don't know who could be. Yeah, let's be honest. Yeah. Kathy Kennedy, of course, longtime Hollywood hotshot film producer. Producer on Force Awakens, the woman running Lucasfilm right now and running it very, very well, to all appearances. Man from U.N.C.L.E., I mean, the clothes of the 60s, the cinematography, the colors of the 60s, the production design is the 60s. It just looks so much like, I mean, this is the origin story the TV show never had. TV show, like TV shows back then, they just start with everything already in place and let's just have a show. This is kind of like the origin story Solo and Kiryakin never got, and they're putting it right back in the proper time period.
It also, it's a geopolitically simpler time. You got you got the Ruskies, you got the West, and you've got this third, you know, this third party that is basically so bad that
they got to team up.
Right. So it's a lot less complicated than, looking at, say, Spy, where there's, you know,
a little harder to figure out what's going on.
Yeah, there's five or six moving pieces there.
Of course, that the third party that was neither side of the Cold War was the original premise of Spectre as well. So it'll be interesting to see how they bring them into the modern day.
Oh, yeah, that's going
to
be
really interesting. Though I guess nowadays that we actually have global terrorist organizations determined to rule the world, as
we do
with Cobra, then don't literally call themselves the special executive for
counterterrorism, revenge, and extortion.
That's and also
what did Thrush stand for anyway?
I don't know that it.
I don't think Thrush.
Did they ever have an acronym?
Well, it started out. It was named WASP originally, and that was changed to Thrush. I think I read that somewhere.
And at some point, they decided it was founded by Sebastian Moran after Professor Moriarty died.
Thrush?
Yeah.
Really? That's so exciting to know. That's beautiful. That's freaking beautiful. That excites me. That's fantastic.
So it started as the remnants of Moriarty's network.
That makes me so happy to know.
That's
beautiful.
I love when people do little details like that. You know, the whole.
I don't know if that ever showed up in the series or just in the novels or what, but I read an article in Dragon Magazine decades ago that explained the origins of Thrush.
I am full of middle-aged squee. I'm looking at this. You know, Henry Cavill is suave and dashing and debonair, and Armie Hammer is properly bludgeon-faced as Ilya Kuryakin, and it's got the lovely Alicia Vikander from Ex Machina.
Still need to see that, too.
Yeah,
it looks interesting.
Yeah, we need to... I don't know if it's still over at the...
We're getting a lot of really, like, conceptual sci-fi movies. That one where Ben Kingsley turns into...
Deadpool.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah, Selfless.
Ryan Reynolds, that's it.
Yeah.
And the one with Matt Damon stuck on Mars for 4 years or whatever.
I am straight tripping about that. Like, have you guys read the book?
No.
Oh my God, read the book.
That was a really cool
book. Go read that book.
Like right now, I can hit the pause button, come back like 3 days later?
Yeah, I'll do it. Yeah, you give the word, we'll do it. If you want to do it that way, we'll do it that way. It's that good. Okay, we can wait till the podcast is over. Then you go read that book, because it's like pure science.
Was it 10? It's got to be more than 10 years. The
Year of the Mars movies.
Yeah, the Year of the Mars.
Yeah, the Mars movies. Like, yeah, you totally ruined the Brian De Palma one for me.
Which one was the Brian De Palma?
That's the one where Tim Robbins takes his helmet off. And
dies. There's no.
And you're right,
the cold equations were not quite so cold.
Yeah.
And you are of course absolutely right that if you know anything about like inertia or, you know, the laws of motion or anything like that, if apparently Mr. De Palma is lacking a sixth grade science education, because if you know anything about Newton's laws of motion, Tim Robbins doesn't have to kill himself in that movie.
Right. It's if you're going to have a closing box movie, if you're going to have, you know, a problem like that, and then
you've got to be rigorous about it.
Okay, small segue. There's a science fiction story. Most of our listeners probably heard it, called The Cold Equations. I hate that story. I am, you know, lots of people hate that story.
Lots of people hated that story from the moment it was published.
It was, that's why the editor probably put it in there, because it was
driven entire careers in NASA, I'm pretty sure.
Yes. Yeah. No, so the upshot is, okay, so there's this little courier ship that is basically going to deliver a vaccine to a planet, and the margins on the mission are such that there, you know, is, you know, no room for extra mass on the ship, and there's a stowaway, and they can't.
What was it, like the captain's fiance or something?
No, it's just the fiance of one of the colonists on the planet they're going to.
Okay. Yeah, so it's basically she's not related to any of the crew, but she's perfectly likable character and such, and there is nowhere for them to complete the mission with enough fuel to land if she's still on board.
So they blow her out the airlock.
Pretty much. Yeah. Now, this is the thing. So people, okay.
Man, astronauts are assholes.
So I have often said, anybody who knows me has probably heard this rant, is, okay, so the whole point to the story is that, you know, sometimes the equations say you're screwed. That's just it. That's life. Now, this is true. I'm willing to accept that on a conceptual level. I merely wish to point out that there are two kinds of people in the world. There are the people that read that and said, yep, okay, sometimes life sucks. And the people that read that hurled the magazine across the room. It says,
get out your damn side rule and find another answer.
Right, and then wrote a long letter into the magazine explaining where they could have possibly...
shoved the magazine.
Could have possibly saved the girl and not... Now, if I'm ever trapped 100,000 miles from home in space and my ship has decided to void its warranty, I know exactly which kind of guys I want back at mission control. It's the second kind of guys, not the first kind of guys.
Absolutely right.
So it's an important story. It's an infuriating story.
You know who doesn't give a damn about the equations? James T. Kirk.
But
in the no-win situation.
You know who else doesn't really give a crap about the equations? Montgomery Scott. He will rewrite the equations. He will complain about it, but then he'll go rewrite the equations.
So, you know, as much as I recognize, yes, sometimes the laws of physics say you're screwed, ask the dinosaurs. You know, I guess if you're going to do that in a movie, then it needs to be airtight. Otherwise, the sacrifice of the character is meaningless if the audience doesn't go, but wait a minute. So, second Mars movie that year, which Red Planet.
With Val Kilmer.
Yes.
Which, Crazy Pants Val Kilmer, but still.
But still, I mean,
he's also Crazy Pants?
Oh, yeah, he's nut. I hear anecdotally that he's a nut bar. But whatever.
That one was a much better shrinking box problem, I thought.
That was also the one that made it, that the trailer made it look like a robot dog goes crazy and kills everyone movie, and that turned out to take up like 5 minutes of the movie.
That's kind of gets us back to, when you find about trailers, the job of the trailer is to make you wish you were seeing the movie right now.
It has to lie to you about the entire type of movie that you were seeing.
Yes.
Now, I think the film they put together ultimately looks just beautiful. Oh, yeah. If it's half as enjoyable as that trailer was, then they've really done something nice.
Yeah, I mean, Hollywood could prove me wrong. I don't see how they could mess this one up. If the movie is as solid as the trailer...
Oh, it's going to be something.
And, you know, unless there's just... I mean, the villain could be the weak point. I mean, I'm not saying... We haven't seen anything to indicate that, but I mean, so far, just what we know about the leads and the setup and just all the shots we've seen so far... They both nail it perfectly. It's going to be entertaining to watch.
Oh yeah.
I don't really see how this can go wrong. I think they have an absolute winner here. Now whether, you know, it actually brings in the, you know, the dollar bills where we get Man from Uncle 2, we'll see.
We'll see. But you know, it's like August right before school starts. It seems like, I don't know, I could be fooling myself because I want the film to be a success. I want it to be good, and I want it to be a success. So I could be fooling myself. But the place and time they're releasing it suggests to me that maybe it'll work.
Well, I mean, we're sitting in a basement, basically, with headphones and microphones shoved in our face and a mixer going here, recording a podcast.
And having great fun doing it.
Yes. Oh, yes, yes. And about spy stuff on a Saturday afternoon, albeit a fairly crappy afternoon.
A rainy, crappy Saturday.
Yeah, I would not want to be outdoors in the Saturday.
Oh, okay. Who are we kidding? This is what we would do on a Saturday anyway.
Fair. So we're just recording it.
We decided to do a podcast because we would talk about this stuff anyway.
This is what we'd be doing anyway.
So we are not possibly the most objective guide of whether this movie is going to do well or not. Yeah. We're going to show up.
Yeah, we're
going to
show up. It's fucking bells on. It's going to be awesome. Right.
But, so this is going to resonate with enough folks who aren't, aficionados of the show, are not spy fans in general. That remains to be seen. Now, the trailer, and I guess that's pretty interesting, the trailer does really have to kill it for this. Yeah. It has to get people to think, wow, that looks really cool. I don't know what the heck this is all about. I'm going to go see that.
Now,
succeeding like blockbusters, as far as I'm concerned, from that. I mean, I can't tell you can see that trailer and not go, wow, I kind of want to see that, unless you just like don't like spy movies or don't like Army Hammer or don't like 1963.
I look at it and I'm thinking, all right, it's got gorgeous clothes and Italian locations, and it's got double entendres in the trailer, and it's got a kind of freewheeling, action-packed, sexy, funny spy movie kind of vibe. I look at this and trying to get as objective as I can about it. You're not going to get the dumb teenager, certainly. I don't think you're going to get the dumb ones, but I think there are some...
They can go see the next Transformers movie, which I'm sure there will be 8 more. I remembered the first bit of what Thresh stands for, so I looked up the rest, and it's even more... No one would ever voluntarily join this than Spectre.
What does it say?
It is... Well, I remembered it. They actually have the first bit that I remembered differently, but I remembered it as technological hierarchy for the removal of undesirables and the subjugation of humanity. And this has it as terrestrial hegemony instead.
But terrestrial hegemony? That's... So apparently Thresh was also founded by college political science professors. Because those are the only people that use the word hegemony in conversation ever. Have you ever, look me in the eye, have you ever used the word hegemony in conversation once in your entire life?
Well, if it's a faction in a board game I'm playing, yes, but I'm not...
Okay, that's fair.
Other than that, no. It's not like I basically say, "Darn it, the hegemony on the interstate connector is just a pain in the ass this morning."
There you go. Now, Stacey, have you ever talked about hegemony in conversation at all once ever?
Some of the people that I hang out with on Facebook are the sorts of people that do use it, so I might have, but not in conversation with like people in person.
I tell you what, the people we knew in college that would use the word hegemony are not the people we hung out with.
That's fair. We knew where they all sat.
They were easy to avoid. We sat on one side of the RAF scaler, they sat on the other side. Smoked a lot, too. Very angry people.
I ended up at that table a lot.
The back table? Or the RAF? Oh, their RAF table.
The RAF table, yeah. Back table. Yeah. The back table is kind of a...
That was our territory, too. Huh, the good old days. So, yeah, Man from U.N.C.L.E. just looks perfect to me. I can't wait to see that. So, do we have any other commentary on these three trailers?
Mission Impossible, I'm kind of torn. It seems like they keep the, they're giving more of a way about, your big action set stuff. Yeah. So you got the big, giant whirlpool.
And they give you more insight into where that might be placed in the movie. It looks like it might be the opening.
I'm not sure on that, except we see pictures of it when they're apparently maybe at what might be a safe house after they've been shut down.
This trailer could be suggesting something deceptively. That's
right. Yeah, so, but the safe house had the unused wetsuit in it, though.
Right. The thing is, and I was kind of torn. Like, my first thought, I was like, well, that's kind of... Wow, they're giving away more and more of all the big set pieces. Is that really a wise move? Because you want people to still be amazed by them. And then they cut to the little scene where there's some sort of robotic arm or thingy in there, and you apparently can't take any metal or oxygen tanks into whatever this thing is. And now I'm trying to figure out what kind of wackadoodle thing is Tom Cruise trying to sneak into? It leaves you with more questions than answers, just like the opener to the Mission Impossible TV show, where see little cuts of this or that and trying to connect that up with when is that coming? Why are they doing that? Why are they there? What is that gizmo for? So the more I think about it, this actually gets back to the roots a lot better. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And B, it now makes me curious. Okay, I don't know all what's going on those scenes. What the heck is going on?
The trailers are playing very much like the opening sequences of an episode where they're showing you the pieces at random and you're left wondering how does this all fit together. It's interesting that the Mission Impossible trailer itself would be a sort of meta version of the show.
Well, but in a sense, the opening to Mission Impossible is a mini trailer to get audiences to say, hey, watch this thing. You want to know what's going on? Guess what? You're going to have to watch all of it, plus the commercials. Yeah. And by the way, you need to sit tight because you don't have a DVR to pause it and record it. You better be paying attention.
That's an interesting thought, is the structure of Mission Impossible itself is designed to make you want to keep watching. Like the meta structure, like the way it's put together, an average drama episode, hopefully they're writing it and performing it in such a way that you'll want to keep watching the show. But Mission Impossible basically cuts together preview trailers within the title sequence and then the apartment scene. They're basically showing you all the bits and pieces of Out of Order, like a movie trailer does, to entice you to watch the rest of the show.
There was a saying about, I can't remember which Doctor Who writer it was, that said, the way you've known you've written a really good Doctor Who episode is when you get done with this little episode for 40-some-odd minutes of television, you go, well, there's that feature sci-fi movie plot wasted.
Yeah.
Mission Impossible... Any one of those could have been spun out to a nice big 2-hour, of them. Oh, okay, the later seasons, maybe not so much, but a nice big 2-hour movie, if you want to.
Basically a heist movie.
Yeah.
Which I'm a little surprised that they went, I like the style of the Mission Impossible movies, but that they went crazy acrobatic action rather than doing them more in the style of like the Ocean's 11 movies.
Well, I think this is a Tom Cruise action vehicle. It's a Tom Cruise movie starring Tom Cruise. Did we mention Tom Cruise?
Yeah.
So I think it came back around to more of the ensemble cast. I think partly out of the popularity of the folks they got in Mission Impossible 3.
Yeah. Mm. Now it's not. I don't think it's coincidental that the movies are becoming better films, critically more popular, financially more successful, the closer they get to the TV show. Well, the closer they hew to the roots of the show, the more successful the films get.
The formula of Mission Impossible was amazingly successful. It's an amazingly compelling formula.
Yeah.
And you're making essentially these mini suspense movies. Well, you have to have a mini trailer at the beginning of your mini suspense movie.
Very nice. I can't wait for that. Oh, this is such a good year to be doing a spy podcast, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, this is...
We've had Kingsman. We've had Spy. We've got at least three more. We've got Man from U.N.C.L.E., Mission Impossible, and the King Daddy of all of them, James Bond, coming out between now and the end of the year. I think they're working on Kingsman 2, by the way.
Mm-hmm. So I've heard. I mean, it did very well, and it was very good. Which is it's always nice to have both. I'd rather, if it's going to be one or the other, I'd rather it be good rather than successful. Let's see, Transformers 4, for example, or the extreme opposite case of that.
Push come to shove, I would rather be good than successful, but it's nice to be both.
Yes, that means you get more of it.
Okay, Spy.
Spy.
Did we all love Spy? I went and saw that with the wife a couple of weekends ago. We did it. Our daughter was at church camp, and she was away for the weekend, and we were actually allowed to go see an R-rated movie spontaneously without a babysitter. I mean, God knows that hasn't happened in 10 years. So we went and enjoyed that movie, got our popcorn, munched it, enjoyed it, laughed our butts off.
It was hilarious. It is.
What's that?
50-50 chance we would have gone to see it if we weren't doing a spy movie podcast already. It was hilarious.
It was genuinely funny.
If we'd not been doing this, we'd not gotten your recommendation, it would have been, maybe we'll go see that, or maybe we'll catch that on DVD, or since it's kind of slightly in the raunch comedy genre,
isn't necessarily what we all go see as our first choice. We don't necessarily do that.
No, it'll wind up on the rotation list next time we visit the brother-in-law, since he's an aficionado. Which is, okay, there's some movies I would not have seen that I enjoyed quite a bit, that I would have never, paid money or, rented in a million flipping years.
Yeah.
There's been others I maybe could have
done without. And that's okay, to each their own. I don't typically go for your raunch comedy as my go-to, but this was a spy movie. This is, to use your phrase, within our remit.
Yes. And on the spectrum of raunch movies, because I've been exposed to them rather a bit more than I ever asked for, it's not that far into it.
Much worse things out there.
Gratuitous vomiting and a lot of vulgarity. But
I didn't think the vomiting was gratuitous. That's her first kill.
The vomiting was not gratuitous.
They could have, if there's a 3D version of this movie, the vomit would have been in 3D.
Yes. The computer generated vomit that lands on the corpse, followed by then the knife tumbling over into the corpse to further defile the dead corpse with the rebar sticking out of its chest. That was gratuitous.
It was gratuitous, but I thought it just.
It was hilarious.
It was hilarious, and it's also very. And this is why I think this movie is so good. It also hones in on her character. She's never killed anybody before. Not directly. She's directly Bradley Fine, who to kill. But she's never actually had blood on her hands before. And there is violence and there is death inherent in this genre that we love so much. She's a regular person. She's never killed somebody before. And it freaks her out a little bit. So it's gratuitous and it's barf and it's bloody and it's violent. But it's also character-based. Like most of the other gags in the movie are. Which is one of the reasons I think this is a very, very strong film.
Well, it works. Okay. It would work totally as a spy movie. You could just say, okay, boom, we're going to, here's our players, and here are our villains, and here's the MacGuffin, and we need to get close to this villain to find out where the MacGuffin is before the MacGuffin is sold to the bad guys.
And there are plenty of relatively serious, normal-ish person gets dragged into the world of espionage movies as well, so you could have done
that. Yeah. You could easily do this, for example, in 1986, starring Sigourney Weaver or Susan Cooper. And you could do a straight spy movie, or you could have done this, a very straight version, sort of. You change the geopolitics around. You could do basically the same story in the 1960s with, Angie Dickinson. I don't know who.
It would have been interesting. Okay, Arnie doesn't normally do a heel turn. You could have very easily done this one with...
Jamie Lee Curtis.
Yeah, with Jamie Lee Curtis in True Lies.
Mid-90s True Lies. This could have been Jamie Lee Curtis as Susan Cooper and Arnold Schwarzenegger's Bradley Fine. You could have done basically the same thing.
Language probably would have been toned down a little bit.
Yeah, but for me, the fact that this is also a comedy, this is the thing. They keep advertising it as a Bond spoof. I just think this is Melissa McCarthy's chance to be James Bond for a movie.
The thing is, I can't tell. Okay, it's kind of a spoof. You've got your tropes, your classic spy tropes. You've got the tuxedos. You've got the gadgets. You've got the exotic location.
The casino scene. You've got the contact you meet in the exotic location. Aldo doesn't die, though. Usually this is the character that dies in the Bond movie to give him further reason to punch somebody's ticket later in the movie. But Aldo, God bless him, doesn't die. And I love that.
And the fact that Aldo is a sleaze is definitely played for kind of, yeah, he's kind of a loser and it's funny. So.
Yeah,
it is.
It's kind of
that everything out of his mouth is some kind of proposition. I would really like to have sex with you now.
Well, the thing is.
Okay, Beth and I have been just doing this one word. Bosoms. We've just been doing that one word for like a couple of weeks now. And it just, all we got to do is just look at each other and just say that and then we crack up. So, yeah, I just loved it. Loved it. Loved it. Love it. Are we going to put an explicit warning on this podcast? We've been using some foul language so far.
I haven't really been, I've been agnostic on whether it's, I'm not claiming the podcast is explicit. I'm not claiming it's clean. I'm simply saying podcast.
We haven't done any, I think we've been trying to avoid potty language on the other three or four we've done so far. But I think this one we should put an explicit warning on it because anyway, I've been swearing a little bit this time. And also I've got to say my favorite line from Spy. This fuckery ends now. Which is my absolute favorite line in the whole movie.
Which,
as you said, you have to keep yourself from ever using in the classroom. Because while it might be very fitting to the situation, it is not
a problem. There's going to come a point where that's the thought in my head, and that's going to be difficult to deal with.
Yeah, that was, I mean, the thing is, and in one sense, I don't think it's a spoof because it's got a perfect serviceable plot with the whole fish out of
water. It's not Austin Powers.
No. But by the same token, you've got all of your classic characters of a spy movie. You've got the villainous. You've got the henchman.
Allison Janney is your M character. Mm-hmm. And you've got Q. Q is hateful. Mm-hmm. Q's just hateful.
He didn't appear as much as I thought from your description. I didn't get the impression he was actively hateful. He was just handing the stuff out.
But. Yeah, but it was all embarrassing stuff. Gadgets.
No, I think there was the question, couldn't we put a different label on it? Well, but I'd have to turn the printer back on.
I don't want to.
Yeah, so it was...
I'd have to turn the printer back on, but I don't want to do
that. It was about as, you know, suave and cool as a visit to the DMV particular scene, which I think was the point. So you've got all of your classic spy movie tropes, but then you've got the words they're saying. I mean, it's appropriate to the situation, but it's like everybody in the movie has some, you know, their little internal filter is off. So they just say the things that come through their heads with no filtering.
Because the villainess just does that all the time.
She is the most relentless. Oh, my God. She's hugely entertaining. She just says really the most god-awful, horrible things that pop into her head. And it is so funny.
To people she professes to like.
Yeah. That's Rose Byrne, who I think I first saw as the Natalie Portman double that dies at the beginning of Attack of the Clones.
Uh-huh.
And she was in Troy with Brad Pitt. Hmm. She was in Neighbors with Seth Rogen last year, which I'm not
going to say. Okay, that's... Okay, yes.
She was also... And we're going to have to cover this at some point, too. It occurred to me. She was also Moira MacTaggert in X-Men First Class.
Mm-hmm. And it's going to be again in Apocalypse.
X-Men First Class, we're going to have to review probably when Apocalypse comes out. Because First Class is a Bond picture.
That's true.
So we're going to have to talk about that too. She's terrific. She's terrific as the villainess in this. You almost want to say over the top, but she's a good enough actress that she manages to bring a little depth, a little bottom to the character. You know, that she's been raised a certain way. She's been raised by an international terrorist who wished he had a son. So there's a reason for her callousness and her cruelty. And Rose Byrne, and I think this is a very talented actress, she's funny and she doesn't really lose your sympathy.
She is strangely sympathetic for the villainess. The other villain, you know, for the inevitable double cross, is also as delightfully sarcastic and saying again, not quite the sort of stuff you'd expect from a villain, in a Bond movie, in a, you know, suave super spy movie, but it works, and it's all just about the only guy who acts like the way you would expect the villain in a spy movie to act like is the Chechen Godfather guy, and he gets, I think, a grand total of 300 seconds of screen time before he's machine gunned.
About that, yeah. This is a great movie. Now I got a thesis to put on the table here. Uh-huh. Why I think this movie, it's funny, and it's got a good story, and it's very well made. I think this movie is a success. You asked me once, and I've been trying to figure out why this particular genre appeals to me the way that it does. And I think this movie really kind of crystallized it for me. I think Spy, in addition to being very much within the genre that we enjoy, a funny movie, a very well-written and performed movie, I think it cuts to the heart of why the genre is appealing to people even now. And in short, it's escapism. It's just pure escapism. Now, you can do the Jean Le Carré spy genre. You could do a whole podcast on Jean Le Carré. Or is it Le Carré?
It's Le Carré. It's got the little accent.
The Le Carré. Jean Le Carré. Or you're Robert Ludlum, or you're Lynn Dighton, or you could do, and that's what else? That's Wallander? There was a spy show called... No, it's not Wallander. It's Callan.
Yeah.
Old Edward Woodward spy show, Callan, and there's for example, Greg Rucka's Queen and Country comic book, and there's an old British spy show called The Sandbaggers.
Uh-huh. It's supposed to be really grim, but also very good.
Right, you can do all the sort of grim, twisty, bleak, dark, morally compromised spy movies, but that's not the ones we're talking about. Escapism. That there are good guys, there are bad guys. There can be areas of gray, but you know who you want to win at the end of the movie. You've got exotic locales, you've got action, you've got adventure, excitement, humor, romance, sex, you name it. That, you know, regular people's lives, and by regular people I mean me, I mean you guys, I mean the people listening to this, all you guys out there, hopefully there will be people out there someday. Your lives, we've got good lives, but we go to work, we come home, we have routine, we have the things we expect, and occasionally you want to get outside that. In fact, I think it's psychologically very important for people to get outside their daily lives. Michael Chabon, Pulitzer winning author for The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, which is an incredible novel, and if you haven't read it, you should. It's about a pair of cousins who are comic book creators in the 30s and 40s in New York City, right when that particular genre was taking off in its infancy and being, you know, formed out of the pure magma of the imaginations of these, you know, 18, 20, 21-year-old Jewish kids in New York. And there's a great line at the end of the book, and I'm not quoting it exactly, but it's kind of stuck with me, where one of the characters muses, why do critics, why do the intelligentsia, why do people look down on escapism? Why is this something that's constantly looked down on? Because most guys, you got to let off steam. You got to get outside your problems. You got to get outside your own head a little bit and have a little fun and relax and clear your head before you come back to your regular life and try to put things together for another day. And I think the spy genre that we talk about here does that better than almost anything. Because you can put in a Bond film from 1979 or 1977. Let's say Spy Who Loved Me, 1977. And there's the Lotus car that goes underwater. And there's Barbara Bach. And there's the ski jump. And there's beautiful giant Ken Adams sets. And it's fun and it's entertaining. And you can relax and laugh and enjoy yourself for a little while. You know, I think the key to this genre, why I love it, is that it offers escapism. A very pure vein of escapism. A very pure way to get outside your own head and relax and enjoy yourself and then come back to the real world. And I put that in air quotes, by the way. Come back to the real world and just try to, you know, do another day of whatever your life is. And I think psychologically that's very important for almost everybody. I mean, how many people, and you're out there right now and you're sitting in your cubicle, you've got your iPod on and you're driving in your car and you're listening to this. And you know there are moments where you would go to the top of the bell tower with the rifle if you didn't have some way to blow off steam. And for some people, that's playing Call of Duty. And for some people, it's, you know, a pickup game of basketball down in the corner. And for some guys come home and, you know, drink a beer and just zone out in front of the TV. And some guys read a novel and some guys do whatever. And for me, and I think for us, I think the spy genre that we talk about, this is one of the ways we do that. And I think this movie, and that Susan Cooper lives a very mundane, regular... Even though she works for the CIA, she's sitting in the basement, there's rats, there's that bitch Karen Walker down the hallway who's always looking down her nose at you. She's basically working in an office environment, and she doesn't really like her life very much. She doesn't like her job very much, and this is her chance to get out and escape, to get out there and have some adventure and some excitement, and we are vicariously living through her. And that's another reason why I think this movie is so good. You get the vicarious adventure through Melissa McCarthy. And normally I get it through like your Harrison Ford, your Dan Craig, your Pierce Brosnan, whatever, but yeah. So that's my hypothesis for the movie and for the genre.
As a movie, it succeeds in large part because of those contrasts. Yeah. And because, yeah. You know, the character, you emphasize the character very much, you know, this is like, the great big adventure. I'm finally going to go out and do the thing I've really, really always wanted to do in my line of work. And it turns out to not be as glamorous and it, you know, as she imagined it to be. And it seems like, you know, everywhere she turns, it's like one setback after another. And you can emphasize with that, maybe not with the whole...
You can't
spy part, but which is the whole, okay, this business trip that was supposed to be exciting turned into mindless drudgery and, you know, walking around airports.
Or the woman in the Algonquin Roundtable, who am I thinking of? What fresh hell is this?
Dorothy Parker,
yeah. Okay. So it's like, so she goes out and she has her adventure, but, you know, it kind of happens the way it would happen to normal people. You know, Susan Cooper, the character in the film, doesn't have a stunt woman. You know, Melissa McCarthy has a stunt woman. Susan Cooper does not have a stunt woman. So she kind of gets hurt. She gets banged up. The chase is
seen. She gets the crappiest hotel.
She gets the worst hotel in Paris. But still, the movie is a really rich vein of escapism, even though she has difficulties that make her easy to empathize with and make the film feel kind of realistic in its aspect. It's still terrific fun.
I like that they established that she actually is really good at shooting in hand-to-hand combat.
Yeah. Oh, the scene where they show the clip from her mm-hmm. training?
Yeah.
Wow. And Allison Janney says, wow, why did I put that on YouTube? And so she's just like rolls into the room and she like shoots three targets and breaks a trainer's arm. I know I'm misremembering
that. Bullets or something, or the gun jams. So she just starts physically beating up the targets and then the trainers come in to try to stop her. So she physically beats them up.
Yeah.
She gets maybe a little carried away, which is, I think, that's kind of definitional of the character. I mean,
And every time you see her fight or shoot, she's incredibly good. She breaks people.
The action choreography in this film is really, really well done.
The fight in the kitchen.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's a fantastic fight scene.
Now, the other one I liked was the chase.
Yeah.
She's chasing the BMW on the scooter.
She's on it's a 428i. She's on a motor scooter. How that works. It's a movie. Don't think about it too much.
Yeah.
But just, it's kind of an exciting chase, but it also every so often just, don't want to spoil the scene, but right after she jumps over it has all of the tropes you expect from that sort of scene, but it also occasionally undermines them or...
To borrow a phrase from the Brits, it takes the piss a little bit.
Yes.
And likewise, that amazing kitchen fight, she's always fighting with really embarrassing improvised kitchen equipment.
Oh, she had a meat cleaver at one point, but it's...
But she's still just as fast and just as good as the crazy assassin lady.
The action scenes are pretty good. I mean, it's a perfectly serviceable spy movie.
Yeah, it really is.
It's got exotic locations in, Italy and Belgrade and such, and it really works as a spy movie.
You add the layer of humor on top of it, and it just makes it that much better.
I want to check. I swear that control room they were in, I think also was in the Fleming miniseries.
You might be right. Apparently that was the most expensive and biggest set that they worked with.
Huh.
Oh, and Budapest actually played itself, Paris, and Rome.
Oh, very good.
In fact, they rewrote most of the film to be set in Budapest because they liked it so much. Originally, it was just going to be doubling other cities.
Wow.
Oh, that's cool.
I was going to say, the writer and director of this film, Paul Feig,
is that how you say his name?
I don't know. I never heard anybody call it out loud before. I assume it's Feig.
Okay.
Kevin, the guy that runs Marvel, Paul Feig, F-E-I-G. And the guy that runs Marvel, Kevin Feige, F-E-I-G-E.
Mm-hmm.
Hell, I don't know. I never heard people say these things out loud before. It's also the guy writing and directing the Ghostbusters reboot due out next year. Now, that's one of those movies that's just perfect the way it is, and I wish they wouldn't reboot it, and I wish they wouldn't rewrite it or change it or remake it or anything. Now, that said, I thought Spy was such a damn good movie. I'm actually really excited about the Ghostbusters thing now. I really am.
Yeah, I mean,
team up between him. Well, apparently almost all of her movies have him behind them.
He's been
They're
on
apparently
a lot of
neighbors
them, yeah.
in Hollywood, really? Wherever it is that they.
Cool.
Yeah. So look, I've written a new script. You can be in it.
Kristen Wiig and Melissa McCarthy, and I think a couple of your Saturday Night Live types are in there, and Chris Hemsworth is playing the Annie Potts role. Now, right there, the phrase, Chris Hemsworth is playing the Annie Potts role, and you see right there, that makes me want to see the movie.
I'm more enthusiastic about the Ghostbusters reboot after seeing this than I was before. I was like, okay.
Oh, yeah.
They know how to. I'm kind of hoping it isn't quite in the raunch comedy spectrum. I just want a nice little action horror comedy movie.
It looks like, just based on the couple of costume shots they showed the other day, that Melissa McCarthy might actually be playing the more straight-laced Ghostbuster, which would be a change from the sort of very vulgar woman that she normally plays.
Now I need to go back and see The Heat. I think the same team plus Sandra Bullock did like a buddy cop picture.
Right.
Cut 2 summers ago, maybe?
Something like that.
So I think if there, he seems someone very comfortable working within the structure of a given genre and making it sing while also making a funny movie.
She was hilarious in Bridesmaids.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that movie was that was a great movie. That was a great movie.
And Paul Feig, or however you say his name, apparently he literally did. He did everything in the making of this movie. This was like his pet project.
Yeah.
Specifically because they're never going to let me make a real James Bond movie.
Yeah.
So I'm going to make my female James Bond
movie. And he made a damn good one,
It was right after seeing Casino Royale, apparently, he decided, I'm going to make a funny Casino Royale.
Woody Allen or whoever decided to do that years ago, and that didn't work out. But this worked out much better than the previous Casino Royale.
Oh, before I forget, Jason Statham.
Yeah, my God.
So
talk about Rick Ford.
Oh, God.
Extreme.
he was probably, I was torn.
In fact, this arm was ripped off, and I put it back on with this arm here. I don't think that's medically possible.
Him and the other analyst were probably. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of torn. The villain was great.
Nancy was
the two
awesome
villains
too,
were great, but Nancy and Rick Ford were also.
And those two parts were specifically written for their actors.
And they really got a call.
Jason Statham and Miranda Hart were both.
Well, for Statham especially.
I once jumped a car on fire off a freeway under the back of the moving train. The car wasn't on fire. I was.
Yeah, I mean, just thinking back to, you know, some of his early work, yeah, this was just perfect. I mean, I particularly appreciate the guy obviously has a sense of humor and is perfectly willing to totally spoof himself because the character is a complete meathead.
Now the movie loses track of Rick Ford for about half an hour. He's just not there. And then he jumps in during the climax of the movie as if from nowhere, wearing a trench coat, a floppy hat, and a pair of blue house shoes. And I just love the idea that Rick Ford has actually been off in his own movie. In his head, he is in his own movie, having his own adventure, gets him to the same point that Susan Cooper is at the end of the movie, but we just don't get to see it. Oh, he's been off having his own extreme version of this movie that we don't even get to see.
I would pay good money to see this movie from his point of view.
Oh, I would love that. I would so love that.
Then he knows he's immune to 179 different types of poison because he drank infiltrated them all at once. Undercover and underground poison ingesting fight club.
And drank them all at once. Yeah. 179 different kinds of poison at once.
Where rich people would bet on who would die first. You ingested poison.
Oh, and somewhere, Michael Bay is looking at a piece of paper going, well, damn, now we can't use that one.
Rip. And he's, God, he is just so funny in this movie. Hey, are you going to tell him that's a lake?
Yes. And yeah, Nancy as the, like, actually not very qualified for field work office lady was.
Oh, yeah, she
came nice very, backup. Very, she came very close to stealing a movie that's very hard to
I
steal.
I saw her in, it was for like 15 minutes or so in some British sitcom on PBS Memorial Day weekend, and
I think it's called Miranda, which is also the actress's
okay,
name.
Okay, so it was just, that was like, oh, that was kind of funny and kind of cute. I'm like, so, you know, I was surprised to see her in this.
Right. Apparently, her whole shtick goes on the fact that she's freakishly tall.
Okay. That's, well, whatever works for you. Mm-hmm. You take, you use what you got. So yeah, I guess thumbs up all around on Spy.
Oh, yes. Oh goodness. Yes.
Oh, the credits. Really,
the credits.
Opening credits and the end credits.
Well, the opening credits were pure James Bond.
Do we tell them what it is? Do we tell the people what it is, or just tell them to watch the credits? Let's tell the people what it is. Make sure you watch the end credits. Ray, yes. Stacy, tell us why. Why do you watch the end credits?
Because you get to basically see all of Susan Cooper's future missions, their code names, you know, the little gadget that, you know, probably gets used somewhere on the mission. And they're all completely plausible missions and utterly ridiculous. And it's great. I mean, there's her cover story, which is kind of a running gag. There's a running gag with her cover stories. And
she always gets
really embarrassing middle-aged lady covers.
Yeah, it's really kind of embarrassing. But it's a good good movie. Watch the credits. Watch the end credits. When you get this thing, watch it in a theater, watch it on home video, whatever, watch the credits.
Yes. I mean, technically, I suppose it's a spoof, and then it's a comedy, and it makes fun of the genre. But it's a lot, if there's a spectrum of spoofs, and Austin Powers is the spy genre spoof, you know, the second Austin Powers movie is the spy genre spoofed to 10, complete with a musical number, then this one is maybe a 3.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not, you know, you could totally just, you could totally watch it as a serviceable spy movie with all the characters suffering from Tourette's, and it works.
Yeah, it works. It works just fine.
Yeah. There are a couple of movies lately that we've seen that we've talked about being, like, actual examples of their genre as well as comedy versions of that genre.
I'll give you a good example of that. Uh-huh. The Phineas and Ferb Star Wars episode.
Oh, which I've not seen.
Which you should see, by the way. Totally off any kind of thing we're supposed to talk about here. But it,
Hey, there's a super spy in Phineas and Ferb.
They're not spoofing Star Wars. This is just their chance to make a Star Wars movie. And they layer some of their own tropes on top of it. But it functions very nicely as a Star Wars story, because this is their chance. And I also submit to you that the Family Guy people who do their Star Wars spoofs, I don't think that's even about spoofing Star Wars. That's just their chance to do it. And they put some gags in there or whatever. But really, they just want to make a Star Wars movie, and this is their shot. And I think this is Paul Feige's chance to make his spy movie. He's never going to get a chance to make this the way he wants to make it. So this is his chance to make that movie.
I think, you know, Phineas and Ferb is well within our remit. It has an agent. Well, yeah, it is a flying Aston Martin at one point.
Yeah, actually, it is within our remit, isn't it? I love that phrase. And we talked about that in our first episode. There's a huge vein of story and comedy material in Phineas and Ferb that doesn't exist if it's not a 60s spy show. So there you go. All right, anything else about Spy?
There's a ton. I don't want to spoil everything in it. It's just,
So how about just go see it?
Yeah, go see it.
Go see it, absolutely.
All right,
apparently it is being unusually successful, so that's...
Well, yeah, it was, yeah.
I would love a spy, too. I would love a spy, too. I really would. And it's a lot better than that Richard Grieco spy picture. You ever watch that one? I'm blanking on the name. Richard Grieco did a spy spoof back in the late 80s, early 90s.
I don't think I saw that one.
I don't know why I'm... I do not know why my mind is fixating on that.
All right, so one cool thing.
It's a lot better than Richard Grieco. A lot better than anything Richard Grieco ever did.
Yes, well, that's the kind
of... Mr. Grieco, if you're listening, it's true. You know it's true. Just admit it.
Was he in the 21 Jump Street?
Yeah, he was the replacement for Johnny Depp.
Oh, so he probably didn't. Or did he?
In the movie,
in the newest movie, they had Depp and one of the other old guys pop up. I think it was Peter DeLuise, actually.
Probably Peter DeLuise.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, probably. Yeah.
That was another example of a movie that my brother got us to watch, but was actually pretty
good. That was actually fairly entertaining.
I have a loathing of Channing Tatum. It's not as bad as the Affleck deal. It's not as bad as the Affleck deal.
We watched Space Werewolf Boyfriend movie finally, so.
Jupiter Ascending.
Oh, Space Werewolf Boyfriend. How was Space Werewolf Boyfriend
movie? It was very pretty to look at. The spaceship's not Channing Tatum. I will defer to my wife's opinion whether Channing Tatum was pretty to look at or not in that movie. He spends an inordinate amount of time not wearing his shirt, having lots of tattoos and scars.
Oh, brother.
But the spaceships, I mean, if you want basically Baroque space wackiness, the visual design is amazing. It is just, you know, I mean, it might be best just mute the darn things. The movie has two settings.
I actually wish I had seen it on the big screen for the visuals.
Yeah,
it is that huge, exotic, imperial, Baroque sort of aesthetic.
Yeah, we were playing a game called Rex, Final Days of an Empire, which is kind of in that vein. I was looking for it for board game day, and we're looking for a movie that we'd already seen, Dune, so I'm like, what else we got in the Baroque space fantasy angle? Okay, we'll try this one.
Better or worse than Chronicles of Riddick?
I liked Chronicles of Riddick.
Not as good.
Okay, good.
Because we saw
Chronicles of Riddick, and we liked that movie.
I'd forgotten about that one for that. That would have fit. That would have kind of fit. But yeah, it's
Chronicles of Riddick is still like we couldn't get the rights to Warhammer, so we're just going to do our thing, and that's fine.
Kind of that vein,
and that's fine.
The movie has two settings. It's basically amazingly, you know, frenetic action, like oh my god, I may have a seizure, and talky. There is not a middle detent on that slide.
You see, here's my theory about the Wachowskis. They wanted to make The Matrix, but it was such a heady concept, such a different way of making a film, that they had to polish the script and get it to a point where a studio executive could understand it and they would know what they were talking about, and you got to work on it and get the storyboards and the production art and make sure everybody understands it all. And then after that, they didn't have to work as hard to make the scripts accessible. And so they didn't. Which gets you Matrix 2 and 3, which gets you, God help me, even though I like it, Speed Racer, and gets you Jupiter Ascending.
I loved Speed Racer.
I did too. I would submit to you, though, that there's 45 minutes of blah, 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 blah that you can cut right out of that movie.
If you're making a movie for kids, it's a little long. And if it's, I don't know, I like it. I like it a lot. I do too. Copy upstairs on Blu-ray. So.
Yeah. Like the movie, you need to lose about half an hour, 45 minutes of it.
You could.
And then now we're at the point where they're not even bothering trying to make the big clunky words, the big word, the character making the words. You're not trying to make that accessible to the common film goer anymore. And it's not that I think things have to be dumbed down, but I do think things need to be accessible for people who haven't read 150,000 philosophy books.
There are some things they could have done in the movie structurally that would this one that would have probably tightened it up a bit and made it more accessible simultaneously.
And does the existence of Sean Bean in a film constitute in and of itself a spoiler?
Actually, I don't think.
Did he eat
it
in this one? Did he eat it in this one?
No.
Actually, he didn't. No, there's one point where I thought he did, but it turned out to be an extra.
Really?
Yeah, it was weird.
It's weird to watch Sean Bean live through a movie.
Yeah, it was kind
of
strange.
Died in GoldenEye, died in Lord of the Rings. What else?
He didn't die in Ronin, but, well, I mean, his soul died, but that's
Well, yeah, that's still pretty close.
I need to watch that again.
All right. So, thank you. Go ahead.
Well, but we can't get out. One cool thing about Spy. And there are a lot of cool things, so this one's a toughie.
This is a tough one. One cool thing. Oh, I love the action sequences. The cool thing, she's elephant. God, I can't even use that phrase. Okay, she's a generously proportioned woman, and there's a certain visual humor in seeing a woman of her particular proportions beat the living shit out of henchmen. That said, the fight choreography was incredible. It was really, really incredible, and that's my one cool thing for this flick. That was incredible choreography.
The kitchen scene we alluded to
is really breathtaking.
Yeah, that's probably the best fight in the movie.
The bit on the plane where she just spontaneously comes up with a new cover that is amazing because she knows, or and any bit in the movie where her past experience as analyst slash girl in the van in the basement is actually useful because she has memorized all this stuff or read research.
And that was, I particularly like that because that was basically kind of the same setup Bond used in, I think it was License to Kill. Where he pawns himself off as a former, you know, British operative of some kind.
Which she is at that point.
Right, technically. She's, at this point she is so far off the reservation, she's in another country, metaphorically speaking. She's also in another country.
Literally speaking. She's also literally in another country.
For me, that's a toughie, because y'all took probably the two I was most going to pick, actually. Okay, when she arrives in Italy, that sequence when she just walks, you know, goes into the casino, and that whole bit I thought was just really slick.
Yeah.
Just you know, because it's, at that point she says, okay, I'm going to not kind of just get close and go off mission, it's, I'm going completely off the reservation, I'm going to get as close as possible to the mark as I possibly can. And I just thought that whole sequence was pretty slick.
And I would say that Stacey and Ray, each of your moments speak very strongly to the character work in the film. Mm-hmm. Number one, her intelligence and her skill. Mm-hmm. She's not saved randomly. She's not saved by chance. She doesn't get lucky. She uses her intelligence and her skill to extricate herself from a very difficult situation. And I would say that when she goes off the red, she gets that dress, she swaggers into the casino. I mean, who amongst us at this table or listening to this podcast hasn't thought about the moment where Bond puts on the tuxedo and swaggers into the casino? That's a moment. It's a wish fulfillment moment that, again, you know, talks about the genre. Fantastic. Listen, if you haven't seen the movie, go see the movie. And go see Spectre, go see Man from U.N.C.L.E., go see Rogue Nation. Come back here for our commentary on these things, where we will attempt to be as humorous, informative, and enlightening as always. Ray, tell me what your Agents of Cool email address is.
It's ray@agentsof.cool.
Very good. Stacey?
Mine is Mrs. Peel, MRSPEEL, no period, @agentsof.cool.
I am number 6 @agentsof.cool. Please visit our website at agentsof.cool. Our podcast is available on iTunes and Stitcher for free. Our Twitter handle, Ray, would be
@agentsofcool.
And if there's anything you particularly want us to cover, let us know. If there's anything you'd like for us to do more of or less of, please let us know. If you like us, tell your friends. If you don't like us, don't tell your friends. They're probably not that interested in your opinion anyway. Thank you for joining us tonight on Agents of Cool. Please tune in next time, where we'll continue our coverage of classic Mission Impossible television and film leading up to the release of Rogue Nation. And then later in the year, we'll be talking about Man from U.N.C.L.E. and getting on the road to Spectre. And there's a lot of interesting stuff to unpack there, too. Thank you very much for listening. Be good to yourselves, and we'll talk to you soon. I would take Daniel Craig as Batman Warren. I'd take Ben Affleck, but that's going to be our other podcast. The Craig's Bond movies.
Who'd you rather take than Ben Affleck?
I'm sorry.
Do you mean that in the biblical sense?
No, I most certainly do not.
I think that would be most of the population of Earth.
And let's just go off on the tangent while we're here. I fucking hate Ben Affleck so fucking much. But anyway,
I thought you'd gotten over that. There's a retrenchment.
Denial.
There was a middle period where you didn't totally, utterly just.
And that's
spit
before.
On the
and that's before they made him Batman.
He could be a good Batman.
Adam West right now is a better Batman than Ben Affleck.
Wow.
They could dig up Bob Kane and put him in the costume. He'd make a better Batman than Ben Affleck. And Bob, whatever. I hate Ben Affleck.